Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 614, titled Oleaginous Diplomacy, Who Still Talks Nowadays of the Armenians, unquote. This is being recorded on October 14th of the year 2007, and before I begin, let me remind you, as always, that there's a vast amount of material available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, and linked websites, particularly those of sister station WFMU. And on those websites, there's a vast amount of material, program descriptions that are article length in length, so to speak, an entire mini library of old anti-fascist books available for download for free. It's all available for free. Years and years of audio archives available from Spitfire, from WFMU, and just a cornucopia of information. So if you're only listening to the broadcasts themselves, you're missing really the vast bulk of the For the Record experience, so to speak. So please do take advantage of that. Myself and others work very hard to bring that to you. Now, the title of the broadcast, Oleaginous Diplomacy, Who Still Talks Nowadays of the Armenians? And that is an allusion to the extermination of the Armenians by the Ottoman Empire during its closing stages during World War I. That is an issue that has festered on the back burner and sometimes on the front burner of politics in the Balkans, politics in the Mediterranean, certainly politics in various parts of what was the Ottoman Empire up until the end of World War I. And it's come back into recent focus as a result of a resolution, well, really as a result of the intersection of several things. For one thing, in the immediate sense, there was a resolution introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives, which passed, to officially label the Turkish genocide against the Armenians for what it was. Genocide, basically, to make a long story short, the Christian or largely Christian Armenian minority in the old Ottoman Empire, which was Islamic and theocratic in nature, during its closing stages, faced a genocidal program at the hands of the Turks. Some 1 million Armenians perished by various means, and that has long been a sore point, certainly among the various Armenian communities around the world. And it also has often emerged as a signpost issue in the adjudication or administration of international law. Now, the Turkish power establishment, the Turkish political and particularly military and intelligence establishment, has long officially and as a matter of record rejected the notion that there was a genocidal program against the Armenians in World War I. They simply allude to it as a catastrophe that occurred for other reasons, largely due to the social strains of war, famine, disease, etc. The issue again now has emerged because of this House resolution, but it has become a particularly thorny issue because Turkey has withdrawn its ambassador to the U.S. for consultation and as a matter of protest. And Turkey also is a very, very important country, not only in terms of NATO. It is a NATO country and the only Muslim NATO country to date. Turkey also is a country through which much of the supply and fuel that eventually finds its way to the U.S. And other allied nation war effort in Iraq goes, basically, so that if Turkey so desired, it could cause a significant rerouting and possible disruption, at least temporarily, of any supply route that would go through there. Now, the situation has been made much more complicated by the fact that the Kurdish minority that exists in Turkey. It exists to a much larger extent across the border into what had been Iraq and what is to this day, what is at this point to a certain extent the semi-autonomous and growing state of Kurdistan. The Kurds are a Muslim minority people in the Middle East who have long sought statehood. They exist in a number of different countries, including Turkey, what had been Iraq, and what is still Iraq, what might get federalized. They exist in other countries. There's Kurds in Iran and Azerbaijan and elsewhere. And they've long sought statehood, and there has been a long festering and oftentimes openly violent conflict between Kurdish elements, particularly a Kurdish nationalist and some say terrorist element, the PKK. PKK elements have indeed been conducting a terrorist and guerrilla warfare campaign against the Turks from newly independent Kurdistan, which has done nothing to make the situation there any better or any simpler. And one of the things that makes this all the more interesting is because very recently it has come to light that in this very, very sensitive area of Kurdistan, Hunt Oil, that's Hunt Oil run by the very powerful ultra-right-wing Hunt family in Texas, sired by Patriarch H.L. Hunt. That ultra-right-wing, very powerful petroleum-based family in Texas has its oil company, Hunt Oil, deeply embedded at this point in the Kurdish oil rights in Kurdistan. There is a great deal of petroleum, and one of the early arrivals, so to speak, on the Kurdish petroleum scene has been Hunt Oil, chaired at this point by a guy named Ray Hunt, who also, surprise, surprise, sits on the, or has sat two terms, basically, on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board of George W. Bush, and as such was privy to sensitive documents about Iraq and other matters. So the dust-up, and it's really more than that, the flare-up of the Armenian genocidal question at this point, once again, is not only in the news, and this is an event that took place in the relatively early part of World War I for the most part. It went on to a certain extent throughout World War I, but particularly in the early years. 1915 was the most vigorous of those years in terms of the Armenian genocide. But with this coming up and with this once again serving to complicate or threatening to complicate, certainly complicating and threatening to greatly complicate the already tumultuous situation in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, we're going to take a look at the Armenian genocide. Now, one of the things that's very interesting about that is that the cover-up, and there was a very formal cover-up of the Armenian genocide, was due to some very cynical and yet perhaps past a point predictable, and to those of us at this point in time, relatively recognizable realpolitik that was stemming from what they call in Texas the all business. And as you look, by the way, at what's going on today all around the world, and particularly in the Middle East and elsewhere where the all business has interest, remember, never forget that the President and Vice President of the United States are petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas. Now, the title of the broadcast, again, is Oleaginous Diplomacy, and the subtitle, Who Still Talks Nowadays of the Armenians? Oleaginous Diplomacy refers to, it's a complicated term launched here by Christopher Simpson in the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, from which we're going to be drawing our material in this broadcast. It refers to petroleum-based diplomacy, basically. Diplomacy that is based on access to or gaining access to oil. That's what oleaginous diplomacy is. And because much of the petroleum in the world was and is in areas that were at the end of World War I part of the now defunct Ottoman Empire, the realpolitik that set in among the victorious countries in World War I with regard to the administration of the breakup of the old Ottoman Empire, which was one of the defeated countries in World War I was accomplished primarily with an eye to getting their hands on the oil, because it was one of the dominant factors in the post-war administration of international affairs with regard to the Middle East, post-war being post-World War I international affairs with regard to the Middle East, was what they call in Texas the oil business. And because so much of that oil business had to do with things that were in the old Ottoman Empire, the issue of punishing and even recognizing the Turkish war crimes against the Armenians became one of the chips, so to speak, that was bargained away in regard for, or in exchange for, access to petroleum, or the diplomatic, political, and legal slash corporate rights to the oil business in the old Ottoman Empire. So when one sees the dust-up that's going on, or the flare-up that's going on today, bear in mind that this has to do with the oil business, and bear in mind, too, that the issue of what happened, or what happened with regard to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, set a precedent for international law, which was not only well-recognized by Adolf Hitler, but which also basically set a precedent for a similar and more drastic cover-up of genocide and of fascism at the end of World War II, which set the stage for not only the Cold War, but also for the post-Cold War resurgence and, I believe, triumph of international fascism. We're going to take a look at some of the people who were involved and some of the elements involved in covering up Nazi genocide against Jews and others in World War II, and their role in helping to administer the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, and that cover-up took place to get access to petroleum. And it is because of that cover-up that Adolf Hitler was able to say, when he was speaking to his generals, basically, who still talks nowadays of the Armenians? And that basically was the rationale, or one of the things that had affected Hitler's attitude toward what he felt was the necessary extermination of peoples who threatened his and what he felt was the German national agenda. What we're going to do now is to turn to the book that's going to comprise the vast bulk of our program. It's going to comprise all of the rest of the information on the broadcast. This is a book called, we're going to be reading from a book called The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. It's authored by Christopher Simpson, and what it talks about is, again, surprise, surprise, money, law, and genocide in the 20th century. And we're going to take a look, first of all, at how the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians influenced Adolf Hitler's worldview and policies. And we're also going to take a look at how oleaginous diplomacy, the access to oil, or diplomacy based on the access to oil, led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians so that people basically could get access to the petroleum that was available in the now dissolving Ottoman Empire. Now, Christopher Simpson's Splendid Blonde Beast, published in softcover by Common Courage Press, copyrighted by Christopher Simpson, 1995. And we're going to take a look at his account of the influence of the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians on Adolf Hitler's genocidal policies. Hitler was well aware of Turkey's genocide of Armenians and of the failure of the international community to respond adequately to it. As early as June of 1931, Hitler commented in an interview that the extermination of the Armenians had led him to the conclusion that the masses of men are mere biological plasticine over which Aryans would eventually triumph. He returned to this theme in a formal talk to his commanding generals on the eve of their invasion of Poland in 1939. Quote, "Our strength is in our quickness and our brutality," he exclaimed. Genghis Khan had millions of women and children killed by his own will and with a gay heart. History sees only in him a great state builder. Thus, for the time being, I have sent to the East my death's head units with the order to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of the Polish race or language. Only in such a way will we win the vital space that we need. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians? On at least three other occasions, Hitler pointed to the brutality of Turkey's regime and its willingness to strike without mercy as a worthy model for his own government. So again, the fact that, again, as Christopher Simpson writes here, Hitler pointed to the brutality of Turkey's regime and its willingness to strike without mercy as a worthy model for his own government is one of the reasons why we're going to be taking a look at what took place with regard to the oleaginous diplomacy that covered up the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. Now, the Ottoman Empire had existed for centuries. It was dissolving in World War I. It was allied with Germany and the Central Powers in World War I. This, by the way, to a certain extent for the benefit of younger listeners. When Turkey, basically, what we call Turkey today, and the empire of which it was the hub, when it was defeated in World War I, it was dissolved. Younger listeners might perhaps want to get a hold of the movie Lawrence of Arabia. It talks about a portion of this conflict, and it's more or less historically accurate. After the regime which was in power during the closing phase of the Ottoman Empire, and which basically was the architect of defeat or military defeat, that defeat really was the product of a long process of social and political decay, but the Itihad Party, and I may not be pronouncing that correctly, Ittihad, the Itihad faction, perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians, a largely Christian minority sect within the Ottoman Empire. That genocide killed some 1 million Armenian, or members of the Armenian minority, and when the Itihad were replaced by a guy named Kemal Ataturk, who basically is viewed correctly as the architect or father of modern Turkey. Among the things that basically became a political football and a major negotiating point and a point of considerable friction was the treatment of many of the people involved with the genocide against the Armenians. This was true for a couple of reasons, or really for several reasons. From the point of view of the people under Ataturk, the new political masters of Turkey, the fact that many of the people that they needed in the military and political and civic establishment for the furtherance of a relatively new, modern, and reformist Turkey were people who, to one extent or another, were directly or indirectly involved with the genocide against the Armenians. There was also the issue of national pride / public relations. It wasn't exactly the best event to have serve as sort of a cognitive launch of the, quote, new, unquote, Turkey in terms of people's background perceptions. From the side of the victorious powers in World War I, the British, the French, and the Americans, they were taking a look at the old Ottoman Empire, and they were taking a look at all the oil, the vast petroleum prize within various parts of what had been the old Ottoman Empire, including Saudi Arabia and what we now call Iraq and Iran. And basically, they were looking to get their hands on the oil business. So oleaginous diplomacy based on the access to oil, became the dominant consideration. And as Christopher Simpson points out, Kemal Ataturk was very skillful in bargaining the exoneration not only of many of the people that had perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians, but also to an extent the actual formal condemnation of the Turkish nation itself in exchange for access on the part of the victor nations to the oil business. Oleaginous diplomacy was the foundation of the cover-up of the genocide against the Armenians. It's what James Stewart Martin, near the end of his book, All Honorable Men, the book that I use to such an extent in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika archive show, and also in For the Record 511, something of a reprise of that archive show. It's what James Stewart Martin referred to as a matter of business necessity. And it was what was viewed as business necessity that also led to the cover-up of the Nazi genocide against the Jews and others in World War II. And among the people whom we've looked at in the past in connection with that is Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, a lawyer, along with his brother John Foster Dulles in the powerful Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Alan Dulles, who along with his brother and fellow Sullivan and Cromwell operative John Foster Dulles, helped to invest the money of, among others, the Bush family in Nazi Germany, in Nazi industry. Alan Dulles was deeply involved in the creation of Saudi Arabia, along with Nazi spy Jack Philby, as well as King Ibn Saud, the founder of, quote, modern, unquote, Saudi Arabia. And Alan Dulles also had much to do with the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. One of the people he worked with very closely was a diplomat who worked in various capacities, a fellow named Bristol, who was openly contemptuous of the Armenians. He hated a great many people, but he felt that it was in the interests of the United States to get their hands on the oil and to keep the Turks strong, and that basically who cared about the Armenians. And Bristol worked very closely with Alan Dulles, the same Alan Dulles who was to work very, very closely with Nazi financial and industrial interests in at the end of World War II. He worked with them long before that, but basically he was able to help to effect a cover-up of the Nazi genocide against the Jews and others, much as he worked to cover up the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, that and as part of the oleaginous diplomacy to gain access to the oil business. Now, we're going to talk about how the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, how the oleaginous diplomacy, how the allocation of early oil rights led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. And one of the lessons that Christopher Simpson draws from this is that basically, ultimately, genocide continues to be performed, and that basically it is overlooked when economic factors are viewed as more important, as they very often are. And that there is, to a certain extent, a precedent that has been set by, among other incidents, the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, that has led to a sort of diplomatic, legal, and international diplomatic and legal inertia that has perpetuated this sort of pro-genocide de facto realpolitik. Now, of the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the extermination or the genocide against the Armenians, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. Importantly, Britain, France, and the United States were at the time vying with one another to divide up the vast oil and mineral wealth of Turkey's Ottoman Empire. Kemal Atatürk skillfully played the three powers against each other and insisted on amnesty for the Ittihadists who had perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians as part of the price for his support in the division of the defunct empire. Though often overlooked today, the Ottoman holdings were of extraordinary value, perhaps the richest imperial treasure since the European seizure of the new world 4 centuries earlier. The empire had been eroding for decades, but by the time of the Turkish defeat in World War I, it still included most of what is today Turkey, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and the oil sheikdoms of the Persian Gulf. The European government sensed at the time that the time had come to seize its rich prize and its oil. The British had been the dominant foreign power in the Middle East prior to World War I. Their Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later known as British Petroleum, or BP, and the Turkish Petroleum Company effectively controlled most of the oil reserves in the region. But the French acquired an important mandate in the area during the war, and by 1919 they were seeking substantial concessions from the British. Both countries preferred to keep the U.S.-backed Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, today known as Exxon, out of the area. The U.S. government, meanwhile, opposed many aspects of the European colonial rule in the Middle East, preferring instead what it termed open-door policies, those that facilitated U.S. penetration of new markets and acquisition of new sources of supply. Senior officials of all three Western powers became preoccupied with oil politics in the Middle East. It even led to an awkward new term, oleaginous diplomacy, unquote, that was used for years to refer to government initiatives on behalf of oil companies. Oil, said French Premier Georges Clemenceau, is as necessary as blood, unquote. For a short time after World War I, the three allies pressed the new Turkish government on two fronts. First, they supported tough punishment for Itahadist criminals, payment of damages to Armenians and Greeks for the lives and property lost during the massacres, establishment of an independent Armenian Republic in northeastern Turkey, and transfer to Greece of the port city of Smyrna. Second, they demanded that the Turks surrender all claims to the resources of the former Ottoman territories outside of Turkey proper, particularly the Mosul oil fields in what is today northern Iraq. Although many Turks saw these terms as humiliatingly onerous, the first post-war Turkish government agreed to them in the Treaty of Sèvres, signed in August of 1920. That agreement was hailed at the time as the formal conclusion of World War I. But the Associated Powers could not agree among themselves on the terms of the division of the Mosul oil fields, and new fighting broke out between the Armenian nationalists who sought to establish the republic they believed had been guaranteed at Sèvres, and the Turkish Kemalists, who still regarded Armenia as a part of Turkey. Kemal's embrace of the Itihadists contributed to an escalating cycle of revenge killings and renewed massacres in Turkey. By the end of 1920, the Kemalists were clearly in the ascendance, having established a rival government at Ankara in the center of the country. The increasingly shaky Turkish government at Istanbul, under intense Kemalist pressure to abrogate the Treaty of Sèvres, abruptly shut down the criminal trials of Itihadists. The Western allies then stepped up their jockeying for influence within the Kemalist camp. The U.S. High Commissioner to Turkey was Admiral Mark L. Bristol, a man with a reputation as a bigot and a determined advocate of U.S. alliance with Mustafa Kemal. "The Armenians," Bristol wrote, "are a race like the Jews. They have little or no national spirit and poor moral character," unquote. It was better for the United States, he contended, to jettison support for the Armenian Republic as soon as possible, stabilize U.S. relations with the emerging Turkish government, and to enlist Kemal's support in gaining access to the oil fields of the former Ottoman Empire. Bristol's argument found a receptive audience in the new Harding administration in Washington, whose affinity for oil interests eventually blossomed into the now famous Teapot Dome bribery scandal. As High Commissioner to Turkey, Bristol had considerably more power than might be enjoyed by any conventional ambassador. As the civil war unfolded inside Turkey, Bristol barred newspaper reporters from access to areas where renewed massacres of Armenians were taking place, purportedly to avoid inciting further atrocities against civilians. And we're going to take a look at the activities of Admiral Bristol and some of the people with whom he worked, including the aforementioned Alan Dulles, but we're going to do that on side two of the program. Again, when I make allusions to other broadcasts and other sources, there is a vast amount of information available on the Spitfire and Link websites, www.spitfirelist.com, www.wfmu.org. There's a blog site. There's an FTR supplemental site with a vast amount of information. Many of the, in fact, just a huge and at this point absolutely essential supplemental body of information to the already incalculably huge amount of information on the Spitfire website. If that sounds corny, if that sounds like an exaggeration, check it out. And also check out side two of For the Record program number 614, because this concludes side one. The title is Oleaginous Diplomacy. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians? This has been recorded on October 14th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.